Gender, War, and the Scholar as Activist, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Miriam Cook of Duke University and Marianne Hirsch of Dartmouth College are here to talk about Miriam Cook's new collection of essays, a volume entitled Gendering War Talk.
The Gulf War damaged received notions of masculinity and femininity. The women who fought, who were injured, and who died participated in an arena quintessentially masculine. They simultaneously subverted concepts of the masculinity of the men who fought beside them and of their own femininity. This disturbance of gender arrangements at the front was reflected at home. Gendering War Talk aims to destroy the myth of the masculinity of soldiering and to change how wars have been fought and will be told.
Miriam Cook of Duke University. She and Marianne Hirsch of Dartmouth College will be here in just a moment to discuss Gendering War Talk, a collection of essays about gender and war in contemporary culture. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. In our century of civil uprisings, political conflict, and genocide, war has been an immediate experience for both soldiers and civilians. It haunts our history and permeates our popular culture. Yet even as the Cold War fades into memory, the reality and rumor of war are changing traditional images of women and men. Miriam Cook teaches at Duke University. With Angela Wallacott, she's co-editor of Gendering War Talk, a new collection of essays that explores gender, war, language, and culture. Showing war as a terrain on which men and women negotiate conceptions of gender, the book examines issues like patriotism and motherhood, the masculinity of war, and the nature of aggression. Joining in the following conversation is Marianne Hirsch, a professor of comparative literature at Dartmouth College and one of the contributors to Gendering War Talk. I asked Miriam Cook to read from her new book.
The roles and representations of women and men in war both confirm and challenge existing images, that women are pacifists or that they're patriotic mothers, that men are essentially aggressive or that they're threatened by their lack of aggressivity. The essays in Gendering War Talk examine the dynamic intersections between men's and women's experience of war and its articulation in language and images.
Miriam Cook and Marianne Hirsch, welcome to the National Humanities Center. Miriam, you have edited a book called Gendering War Talk. Marianne, you've got a piece in here that you wrote with your spouse, Leo Spitzer. I congratulate you on the book. Miriam, let me begin with this question. Is war masculine? Is it a male proposition?
Well, when you ask me this question, it reminds me of a sentence in Sarah Ruddick's piece in this same book, where she says, "Nearly everyone accepts that war is generally masculine." So, if we can, these aren't exactly her words, but this is the sentiment. And if we can put it that way, then yes, it is. From my perspective, I would say that it is not so much war that is masculine, but two aspects of it. One is the military, so that is state structures that are geared to make war, stop wars. And the other part of war that is masculine is the way war has always been represented, particularly in what I have referred to as a Homeric war myth. In other words, the way that war has always been told in a particular way that has relied on the binary structure based in gender, that war is that place and that action where men are, where men do and are active, and whatever is not war, the home front, as we now call it, is where women are, where women don't do anything much. It's where they're passive.
Let me turn to you, Marianne Hirsch. Does this mean that we should de-sex literature, that we should figure out a way to do literature and the telling of our narratives certainly war is central to these narratives that we call books and poems and novels and all that sort of stuff. Do we de-sex literature to get rid of war?
Well, wow. If it were that easy, maybe we would try it. but I don't think it would work quite in that way. I think one of the things that nearly everyone in this book agrees on is not that we need to de-sex literature, but that we need to undo the binaries. The binary structures, and gender is probably one of the primary binary structures on which our culture is based.
All right, now wait, stop you for a minute. When you say binary structure, that's a bit of theoretical talk. What are we talking about? Males and females, that there's a necessary opposition in the way men and women look at things and understand their experience? Miriam?
Not necessary, but that is the way we think. We think in oppositions of twos, so that we have war and peace, and men and women, and combatants and non-combatants, and home and front, and offensive and defensive action, and victory and defeat.
So if we create new categories of approaching human experience and reporting to one another about it, then the likelihood is that we're all going to become pacifists and we won't have war?
Well, that clearly is a hope. But I think before we can be too utopian and immediate in our aspirations for a different way of thinking, what we have to do is try to see ways in which we can at least influence this kind of thinking, so that instead of thinking in twos, we think holistically. Mm-hmm. We think of war, for example, the most divided activity, the most shaped by binary structures, in the way that it is actually fought, and that is in a holistic way.
Marianne, let me turn to you again. You and your spouse, Leo Spitzer, have contributed a piece to this volume called Gendered Translations. You talk about the Holocaust, and you talk about the role of gender, that women obviously were a part of all of that, and yet in the telling and the reporting, they're not. Unpack that for me.
Well, we talk about particularly a film by Claude Lanzmann called Shoah, a 9.5-hour epic film about the memory of the extermination, the process of extermination, the death camps, and the very process that put people to death, put Jews primarily to death. And we talk about how the narrative is told in this 9.5-hour film, and in fact that it becomes a very masculine narrative, and that women are left out as the main storytellers. And we try to say why, without criticizing this film, which we think is a phenomenal film, try to see why some of those voices have been silenced. And
do we use a word like conspiracy? I mean, how negative? What is the dark side here that women got left out?
Well, women are left out of a lot of the narratives of war, and I think that's one of the running themes in this book, is to look at the silences and allow the silences to speak, so that then we can perhaps come back and reverse some of that silence to create new stories, and maybe through those new stories to see things in a new way.
Miriam, your piece in this book, Gendering War Talk, is, well, you say that it is an unsayable title. You have the letters W-O slashed out, hyphen M-A-N, woman. Again, unpack this for me, the presence, the absence of women in war talk.
That's very nicely put, because that's exactly the issue that I've been dealing with, and that I think most of us have been dealing with in the book, and that is the actual presence out there in the field, out there in the camps, and their written absence. Because for most of us participating in the institute that was the basis for the book, for most of us, what matters is what happens in the representation of war, and that is that for war to be acceptable, it has to be told in a particular way. War talk has to have a particular structure into which it fits, so that if we have women in
you
war.
You upset the apple cart.
You do, because yeah. women are supposed to be defenseless, right. and men are supposed to be defenders, and that is one of the primary ways that governments have been able to mobilize their people.
Sure. One of the pieces in here is Carol Kahn's piece about the way the generals at the military establishment, we've got to be careful of stereotypes here, of course, but at the Pentagon, the way they mm-hmm. talk about war, it's almost a parody. It's almost something that you would see on Saturday Night Live. I mean, all this fallow this and fallocentric that, and yet this is the truth. I mean, there is. She's got documentary evidence here that our language tends to shape the way we see the world.
You said a little earlier, is there a conspiracy? Mm-hmm. And I think there's certainly not a conscious conspiracy, I don't think, anyhow. But there has been, in a way, almost a kind of implicit conspiracy that there are ways in which we talk about war that are highly gendered and that people tolerate.
Let me pitch this to you, Miriam Cook and Marianne Hirsch. As we record this conversation in the spring of 1993 in the Raleigh News and Observer, one of our local papers has just run a piece here about a woman who wanted to be a combat pilot in World War II. And she's now looking back and saying, applauding the fact mm-hmm. that women now appear to be on the verge of occupying that kind of position. Now, we have a very mixed bag here. On the one hand, she's a woman. Therefore, she should be a pacifist? She should, what, not endorse the whole concept mm-hmm. of war? Marianne, talk to me about that.
Well, I guess this is the real question that Miriam and I disagree somewhat about. Can we really change the military by including women? Would the military become a very different kind of institution if women had equal roles in it? And I think
you say yes, and she says no?
I'm skeptical, but Miriam has much more hope, so I'll let her talk.
Well, I think that it is very important that the masculinizing of the military be changed. And when we talk to people who are currently in the military, who are seeing more and more women, in fact, as some of the generals and the people in charge of recruitment and are saying, well, you know, not many people want to be in the military, so we have to turn to women, and we have to, you know, we're just having a problem recruiting sufficient numbers. As these people are bringing in more women, they're having to change the physical structure for a start. Separate showers, separate quarters for women, of course not in ships, but in general back at the base camp. Different kinds of uniforms, childcare, you know, for the families, because we aren't dealing with a military of men, as, for example, the Italian military until only a few months ago had no women at all. Mm-hmm. And now, as we change the physical structure, we're also beginning to have to change things like the mentality, the cadences, for example. How are we going to get our military to march well if they can't use powerfully misogynist language? Mm-hmm. And feminists are, like Carol Burke, are beginning to really look at the problems in the language that is used to get men and women going.
Let me argue with you for a moment, Miriam. If we look at the Middle East and we look at the Israeli army, my understanding, I don't pretend to be an expert on this, is that that women play a role in the Israeli military, and this is one of the most hawkish of all of the military organizations in the world. And I say this without trying to be polemical or ideological or get us into questions of race and religion mm-hmm. and the military. What about it?
Well, the Israeli military has often been invoked as that place where men and women are equally involved. And, of course, this is almost the opposite of what we've been talking about. In other words, the women are there, but they are not anywhere near combat positions. Uh-huh. Combat position, of course, means that you have a chance to be promoted. The it is known that the only way that one can move one's way up the hierarchy is to have proven oneself in battle.
Well, as that possibility presents itself in the American military, don't we have a kind of an irony at work here, that as women work their way higher up in the military, we're going to make women warlike, or are we going to make the generals, the male generals, mm-hmm. less warlike? Marianne?
Well, I guess the hope is that, you know, as Miriam was saying earlier, why am I so happy that women are going to be allowed to fight and to kill?
Right.
Well, perhaps that if women have those roles, perhaps they will then want to not fight and not kill,
mm-hmm.
and will want to engage in something that Sarah Ruddick in the book calls peacemaking.
Right.
Pacifism is really not a good term because mm-hmm. it sounds so passive, and it sounds like we're not doing anything, and we value activity, and certainly the military values activity.
Again, let me stop you for a moment. Isn't it a really a kind of a dismal or a cynical view of human nature to say that women are, pardon the expression, the good guys, and males are, pardon the expression, the bad guys, and that if we can get men to think like women, then there won't be any war anymore? Isn't that a kind of a lopsided view of our common human nature?
Well, I think that part of the difficulty of this new field, gender and war, is that in some ways it does depend on a paradox. And that is that we want to get women in to the story. We mm-hmm. want to get women represented as being in war, in the military, in the war story, so that it becomes more difficult for war to happen, so that it is profoundly paradoxical. But
right.
I think that that is the insight of feminist theory.
Let me again turn to Marianne Hirsch. Marianne, you are a professor of literature, French specifically, up at Dartmouth. Miriam Cook just mentions our stories, our narratives. Is it naive to think that if we teach literature from the standpoint of making our students sensitive to issues of gender, particularly when we talk about war and the military and war mm-hmm. stories, that we're going to move away from being warlike? Again, the language mm-hmm. driving our sense of reality.
Well, I think what we would really like to do is to try to examine what makes masculinity, what makes femininity, and how those are connected to war making and to peacemaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think teaching literature or writing about literature or writing literature itself is one way to maybe bring those issues up into the foreground and to see what makes us masculine, what makes us feminine, and what creates war and peace.
Are you going to argue that our sense of femininity or masculinity is entirely socially constructed? When we talk about the wellsprings of our behavior, it's one thing to see it raw, phenomenal, unfiltered. It's another thing to see it fed to us, as it were, in literature, in stories, and in narrative. I mean, we're really getting back to some basic stuff here, are we not?
Well, these are very subtle issues, and I think that it's one of the things that we found in this article about about Holocaust memory and about Holocaust stories. I mean, these are very subtle exclusions. Why, in this 9.5-hour film about the death camps, are women's voices not there? This is a very subtle kind of exclusion, and I think that in teaching literature what we're hoping is to really look at some of those subtleties and some of the subtleties of inclusion and exclusion and of power. Who has the stories and who has been left out of the stories?
So what do we do? Do we revise our social, cultural, literary canons to make adjustments that increase our sensitivity away from being warlike and toward being pacifist? Marianne?
Well, that certainly would be one way. I think, and this is something that, of course, I wrote about in my essay on the wars in Lebanon and Palestine, Israel, and in Algeria, what is critical is that women become aware of the importance of writing. And I think that's what those of us who were at the Dartmouth Institute and who are the contributors to this volume, what we have all felt is that we are writing certainly theoretical pieces, but that our writing is itself activist. And we are one step along from those Arab women that I have studied who have said, I was in war, I contributed the same as a man, because to answer your first question, I think war itself mixes gender roles and expectations. So the women who have had that experience, who don't have a stake in maintaining the war story, can say, no, the war story is not true. Mm-hmm. This isn't the way things worked. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I contributed, and what happened in the Algerian case was, hey, when the war was over, people needed to know that the war was over. And the way that you know that is everything goes back to status quo ante. So, oh, right, you have to have the women back home. And what the Palestinian women are now learning in the occupied territories in Israel is they have to write about the different roles that they have played. Their effectiveness in the current intifada, or they were more effective before it became sort of official, but at the same time they have to continue to be activist. Mm-hmm. And I think this balance between theory and activism, between writing and being out there at the barricades, is absolutely critical. Literature, changing literature on its own is not enough.
Mm-hmm. Marianne, let me again turn to you. You're a professor up at Dartmouth. You do literature and literary studies. How strongly does this stuff come through in the way you teach and in the way your undergraduates react to the doing of literature?
Well, I think what comes through very strongly is precisely this need to that Miriam was just talking about, for theory and practice, for theory and practice to work together. And as feminists, I think one of the reasons that we're interested in studying war, I mean, you might say, why are feminists interested in studying war? Well, as feminists, we're interested in studying war because war can work as a kind of prism to make us understand gender relations and gender attitudes. And I think once we understand some of those things, I think we're already practicing some of these things. Mm-hmm. So, for example, on the day the Gulf War started, I walked into class. It was an introductory class in comparative literature. And I couldn't teach that class in the way that I wanted to teach it. I had to look at some poetry that was poetry about war and that was talking about fighter-bomber pilots throwing bombs. In this case, a poem by James Dickey, mm-hmm. Which was not about this very situation. But I really thought that the students had to see how that experience had been studied in poetry or written about in poetry before.
Mm-hmm. Miriam, and let me again argue with you politely here. What about the criticisms that you professors might take that you are, as Marianne has been describing this situation at Dartmouth and you teach at Duke, that you're politicizing the teaching of literature, that you're politicizing teaching, period? Some parents may say, wait a minute, I'm not paying these high bills, you know, to have you preach a particular doctrine to my kids. It may not come through as crudely as that, but what about that?
Well, I would say that all teaching is politicized. Some is implicitly politicized, and very often people are not aware of their own politics, and that's much more dangerous, I think, than somebody who is overtly political, who knows where he or she stands.
So you sort of stake your territory out and politely say, this is it, this is where I'm coming from.
Yes, of course, you're asking about war, and I have just introduced a new course with a colleague of mine at Duke, who's a military historian, mm-hmm. Alex Rowland, and we have been struggling to create a bridge between the community that I think I belong to, which is feminists who've become interested in war, and the community that he would, I think, say he belongs to, and that is military scholars or scholars interested in military studies.
So this is a healthy sign. I mean, I take it that this is a signal of optimism.
Yes, and of course, in this class, we have to be very clear about where we're coming from, because what we're trying to do is we're trying to learn from each other, and if we aren't clear about our politics, if we don't understand why it is that we're doing what we're doing, we're not going to learn from each other, because mm-hmm. then we have all these unquestioned assumptions, which, as long as they aren't questioned, will make it impossible for us to hear each other.
Well, we may live in a fallen world, but at least I hear a little bit of optimism coming through here. Am I right?
Oh, I am inordinately optimistic.
Well, I want to thank you both for your lively insights and overview of this book that you have published. Let me tell our listeners about you. Miriam Cook, you teach Arabic language and literature over at Duke University. You are the director of Asian and African Languages and Literature at Duke. Marian Hirsch, you've been a fellow of the National Humanities Center this year. You're a professor of French and comparative literature up at Dartmouth. And the title of the book that we have been discussing is Gendering War Talk. Miriam Cook is the co-editor, along with Angela Wallacott, who is a professor of history at Case Western. I got all that right?
Yes.
All
yes.
right. Marianne, or Mariana, I should say, and Miriam Cook, I want to thank you both very much for participating on Soundings. Good luck in your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ann.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. You've been listening to a conversation about gender, war, and contemporary culture. My guests were Miriam Cook of Duke University and Marianne Hirsch of Dartmouth College. With Angela Wallacott, Miriam Cook is co-editor of a new volume of essays entitled Gendering War Talk. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 672. That's program number 672, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Next week, Rethinking Early English and French Literature. Join me for conversations featuring Catherine O'Brien O'Keefe of the University of Notre Dame and Edwin Duval of Yale University. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.